Welcome to The Word at First Pres. Our fall sermon series is called Come to Jesus Moments. Throughout this series, we will be having hard conversations about important issues that impact all of our lives. Thanks for listening.
And our first reading is Genesis chapter 4. Now the man knew his wife Eve, and she conceived and bore Cain, saying, I have produced a man with the help of the Lord. Next, she bore his brother Abel. Now Abel was a keeper of sheep, and Cain a tiller of the ground. In the course of time, Cain brought to the Lord an offering of the fruit of the ground, and Abel, for his part, brought of the firstlings of his flock, their fat portions. And the Lord had regard for Abel and his offering, but for Cain and his offering, he had no regard. So Cain was very angry, and his countenance fell. The Lord said to Cain, why are you angry? And why is your countenance fallen? If you do well, will you not be accepted? And if you do not do well, sin is lurking at the door. Its desire is for you, but you must master it. Cain said to his brother Abel, let us go out to the field. And when they were in the field, Cain rose up and killed his brother Abel. Then the Lord said to Cain, where's your brother Abel? And he said, I do not know. Am I my brother's keeper? And the Lord said, what have you done? Listen, your brother's blood is crying out to me from the ground, and now you are cursed from the ground, which has opened its mouth to receive your brother's blood from your hand. When you till the ground, it will no longer yield to you its strength. You will be a fugitive and a wanderer on the earth. Cain said to the Lord, my punishment is greater than I can bear. Today you have driven me away from the soil, and I shall be hidden from your face. I shall be a fugitive and a wanderer on the earth, and anyone who meets me may kill me. And the Lord said to him, not so. Whoever kills Cain will suffer a sevenfold vengeance. And the Lord put a mark on Cain so that no one who came upon him would kill him. Then Cain went away from the presence of the Lord and settled in the land of Nod, east of Eden. The word of the Lord. Thanks be to God.
Our second scripture reading comes from Mark 11, 15 to 18. Then they came to Jerusalem, and he entered the temple and began to drive out those who were selling and those who were buying in the temple, and he overturned the tables of the money changers and the seats of those who sold doves. And he would not allow anyone to carry anything through the temple. He was teaching and saying, is it not written, my house shall be called a house of prayer for all nations? But you have made it a den of robbers. And when the chief priests and the scribes heard it, they kept looking for a way to kill him, for they were afraid of him, because the whole crowd was spellbound by his teaching. The word of the Lord. So during the fall, we are doing a sermon series called Come to Jesus Moments. A come to Jesus moment or a come to Jesus talk is when we're having a hard conversation about an important topic. And throughout the fall, we're going to be having many of these hard conversations. Maybe it's about things that impact you personally. Maybe it's about Christianity and the church. Maybe it's about culture and society. Maybe it's all three at once. But we're going to be talking about these things because if you don't talk about them, you can't ever do anything to correct them. Would you agree with that? Yeah. So it's going to be hard to do it. But my hope is that by talking about these things, we can make little changes that can make a big impact on our community. So I told you each week, we're turning up the heat a little bit. We're going to turn it up a little bit more today. And to begin, I want to play an episode or a part of an episode from This American Life. I don't know if you've ever heard of it. It's a radio show where they go around and they basically interview people from all over America and sometimes the world. And they have a theme for their show each week. And the theme of this particular show was about children and how when they learn when they're young, they are gathering information and they can come to conclusions which to them are logical but may actually be incorrect, or they come to conclusions that are quite profound. And so I wanted to play this little vignette for you because I thought it would lay the foundation of what we're talking about today extraordinarily well. So let's listen.
Well, it all began at Christmas 2 years ago when my daughter was 4 years old. And it was the first time that she had ever asked about what did this holiday mean. And so I explained to her that this was celebrating the birth of Jesus. And she wanted to know more about that. And we went out and bought a kid's Bible and had these readings at night. She loved them, wanted to know everything about Jesus. So we read a lot about his birth and about his teaching. And she would ask constantly what that phrase was. And I would explain to her that it was, "Do unto others as you would have them do unto you." And we would talk about those old words and what that all meant, you know. And then one day we were driving past a big church, and out front was an enormous crucifix. She said, "Who is that?" And I guess I'd never really told that part of the story. So I had this sort of, that's Jesus. And I forgot to tell you the ending. Yeah, well, you know, he ran afoul of the Roman government. You know, this message that he had was so radical and unnerving to the prevailing authorities of the time that they had to kill him. They came to the conclusion that he would have to die. That message was too troublesome. So it was about a month later after that Christmas. We'd gone through the whole story of what Christmas meant, and it was mid-January, and her preschool celebrates the same holidays as the local schools. So Martin Luther King Day was off. So I knocked off work that day, and I decided we'd play, and I'd take her out to lunch. And we were sitting in there, and right on the table where we happened to plop down was the art section of the local newspaper. And there, big as life, was a huge drawing by like a 10-year-old kid in the local schools of Martin Luther King. And she said, "Who's that?" And I said, "Well, as it happens, that's Martin Luther King. And he's why you're not in school today. So we're celebrating his birthday. This is the day we celebrate his life." And she said, "So who was he?" And I said, "Well, he was a preacher." And she looks up at me and goes, "For Jesus?" And I said, yeah, actually he was. But there was another thing that he was really famous for, which is that he had a message, you know. And you're trying to say this to a four-year-old. It's very, you know, this is the first time they ever hear anything. So you're just very careful about how you phrase everything. So I said, you know, he was a preacher, and he had a message. And she said, "What was his message?" I said, "Well, he said that you should treat everybody the same no matter what they look like." And she thought about that for a minute. And she said, "Well, that's what Jesus said." And I said, "Yeah, I guess it is. You know, I never thought of it that way, but yeah." And that is sort of like, do unto others as you would have them do unto you. And she thought for a minute and looked up at me and said, "Did they kill him too?"
So today, we are going to be talking about a very difficult topic. We're going to be talking about racism, which in a predominantly white church like our own is a topic that most people don't like to discuss. And that's generally for two reasons. One, it either makes us feel really guilty, or two, we don't entirely know what to do because the problem seems so big and so intractable. And I want to start off by saying my goal today in talking about this is actually not to make you feel guilty. That's not what I'm doing up here. My goal today is to talk to you about the history of the Christian faith and how Christianity has contributed to the ideology of racism that is still persistent in this country today. So that's our goal. And I think we need to address this if we're going to be able to move forward as a church. So are we all on the same page? Uncomfortable as it may be? All right. Now, in order to do this, we need to go back. We need to go back to kind of the beginnings of our country, which you all are probably well aware of this history, but we're just going to walk through it for a second. So around the early 1600s, what we see is that various powers, England and different countries in Europe, they start making their way across the Atlantic to the New World, the North American continent. And as more people come over, they start forming colonies. And at the time that this was happening, slavery was legal in England in these various countries, and so when many people would come over, they would bring their slaves with them. And if we fast forward from the early 1600s to 1700, what you see is that actually many of these countries, they had started to really infiltrate the North American continent. So you can see right here, this is around 1700, you can see that England, they of course had taken over the East Coast. France, they had taken the center, and then Spain, they had taken kind of the southern sections in Mexico, what we know today. And so as these colonies came in and kind of took over these different areas, what the English discovered was that the further south you go into the United States, the better that land is for farming because it's warmer and, of course, it's more fertile soil. And so what they determined was that if you were going to really make use of this landscape, you needed a large labor pool. And at the time, there weren't as many people over there to really utilize that land in the way they wanted to. So they tapped into the African slave trade, which was really big at that time. They were producing a lot of slaves, bringing them out of Africa to various parts of the world. So we fast forward a little bit more, like we can move forward a little bit further in our history. And of course, what happens is, the colonies, the British colonies, we go through a revolutionary war and we throw off the English who were ruling over us at that point in time, and we get to 1787, which is the Constitutional Convention. Now in this time, from 1700 to 1787, there had been a large movement of Christians over in England. They became known as abolitionist Christians, who were saying we should get rid of slavery. We should abolish it. It should be outlawed. This was big over in England. And of course, this made its way across to the United States. And so at the Constitutional Convention, this was a big point of contention. Should we outlaw slavery? Should we keep it legal? The northern states, they said, we kind of feel like we can get rid of it and we'd be fine. The southern states said, we're too economically dependent upon slavery. And the tension in this became so thick that it threatened to have the whole Constitutional Convention collapse. And so what ends up happening is they let go of it with the hopes that in a few years, maybe a decade, they could put forth a constitutional amendment that would then be ratified to abolish slavery in totality. Now, this might have actually occurred had it not been for one invention that changed the entire trajectory of the history of the United States, and that is the cotton gin, which was created by Eli Whitney. So you all are probably aware that cotton grows very, very well in the South. The problem with cotton, though, is that it's very hard to separate the cotton fibers from the seed that it's attached to. It's hard to get it out because it's kind of slippery. And so what would happen is these cotton farms, which actually didn't make any money, they were not profitable at all. They could only produce, on average, if you had one person working on cotton, you could produce about 1 pound of cotton lint per day. His invention made it so that you could produce around 55 pounds of cotton lint per day. It totally transformed the process. And so this invention, which was actually so ingenious because it was so simple, what ends up happening is people look at it, and it's so simple that people can just make their own. They don't even have to use. He made almost no money off of his patent because people just looked at it and they said, I can do this. And so they created it, and it became this huge cottage industry down in the South. And by 1830, the United States was the number one exporter of cotton in the world. Now, of course, what ends up happening is this supercharges the African slave trade. If you remember my first sermon in this series, remember what it was? The technology paradox. And what was that about? The idea that there's a piece of technology that you create it, and it's for one thing, and then it has these unintended consequences. And the unintended consequence of this is that it resulted in the enslavement of millions of Africans. So all of a sudden, there's all this money coming into the South They have all this money, and there's all these slave owners. And that money starts to find its way into the church. And a great example of this would be my great-great-grandfather. My great-great-grandfather, he owned a plantation, the largest in our town, and he was a slaveholder. And he went to the Presbyterian Church in Fredericksburg, where I grew up, where I went to church. And he gave a lot of money to that church. Generally speaking, Christianity and slavery don't work super well together. Just saying that, right? Because the fundamental core premise of Christianity is that all humans are of equal dignity and value. You can see this all throughout the Bible. One of the best scriptures that kind of shows this is Paul's letter to the Galatians. We read this last week. But it says, there's no longer Jew or Greek. There's no longer slave or free. There are no longer male or female. For all of you are one in Christ Jesus. The idea that in God's eyes, everyone is the same. Now, I want to ask you a question. What does it take to enslave another human being? And just a little side note, but you may not know this, but there is actually more slavery today in the world than there has been at any point in human history. More human beings today are being trafficked than at any point in human history, which is kind of hard to believe, but it's true. So what does it take for a person to enslave another human being? Well, you can't see them as equal, can you? Like, I can't enslave a person thinking that they're the same as me, right? That doesn't work. I can't look at you and say, you are of equal dignity and value, and then turn around and say, you are my property, and I now own you, right? These are conflicting values. You can't make them work together. So what ends up happening in the South is that there are these pastors, like me, standing up in the pulpit, and they have slave owners in their congregation. And they're trying to figure out, how do I make this work? And they come up with theology and interpretations of Scripture that undercut this concept that all humans are of equal value and dignity. One of those examples, and one of the most inventive interpretations, comes from the story of Cain and Abel. So, story of Cain and Abel, very simple, right? Cain kills Abel, they're brothers, right? Cain kills Abel, God finds out about it, ends up banishing Cain from the land, and he is cursed, right? And he says, God, if you send me out into the world, what's going to happen? People could kill me. And God says, no, anybody who kills you will be cursed seven times what you have been cursed. And in order to make sure nobody kills you, God places a mark on Cain. This is what it says. And the Lord put a mark on Cain so that no one who came upon him would kill him. Now, what these southern pastors did is they said that when Adam and Eve were created, Adam's formed from the dust, the clay of the earth, right? And Eve is formed from his rib, that they were white, and that Cain and Abel were white. And that after Cain kills Abel, the mark that God places on Cain is dark skin. And therefore, if you are a descendant of Cain, if you're a person with dark skin, you are a descendant of Cain and are therefore cursed. How are they able to do this? Well, look at that scripture. Does it tell you what the mark is? No, it doesn't. It doesn't say what it is at all. So you can interpolate, you can insert that into the text. So what ends up happening is that you take this idea, right, that anybody who has dark skin is a descendant of Cain, and that person has been cursed by God. And once that person has been cursed by God, that gives you the ability to then look at them as being less than. They are less human than you are, and therefore they can be subjugated. Now, how do you go from having a mark to being subjugated? Well, all you have to do is look at other scriptures where God tells the Israelites they're going into the promised land, and when people didn't make the cut, what would God tell them to do? Well, if you're going in there and you see these people, you can subjugate them, you can enslave them, you can wipe them out completely. Take a look at Deuteronomy right here. When the Lord your God brings you into the land that you are about to enter and occupy, and when the Lord your God gives them over to you and you defeat them, you must utterly destroy them. Make no covenant with them and show them no mercy. So they take these two ideas and they blend them together. If you have the mark, you are cursed, and therefore I can subjugate and enslave you if I so choose. So, some of you might be sitting here, we'll pause for a second. Some of you might be sitting here thinking to yourself, well, Alex, that was the 1800s. I mean, come on. That was a long time ago, right? It's 2022. Why are we talking about that? Well, it has a lot to do with what's going on today. Because what ended up happening was this theology where black and brown bodies were seen as being less human than white bodies, that theology gets baked into the culture of the United States, and it ends up fueling a lot of the racial ideas that people have going forward, even to this day. And so I'll show you. I can show you how it all lays out. Okay, so we fast forward again after the Civil War, right? What happens after the Civil War? There's a law that comes into place that, of course, abolishes slavery. But that doesn't mean that the theology just goes away, right? It doesn't mean that all that theology that made it work goes away. What ends up happening is the theology stays in place. Because the same theology that can justify slavery is now used to justify segregation. It's the same thing, no difference. So we fast forward another 100 years. We go to the 1950s and 60s, right? And what ends up happening is this theology, which has been used consistently in white churches, is still very prevalent. Now, I'm going to ask you all another question. Do you all believe that the civil rights movement of the 1950s and 60s was a good thing? I would just hope so. I mean, I assume most of you would say, yes, it was a good thing, right? And when we look back on that movement today, I think most people say, yeah, that was good. And I think most people looking back would say, Martin Luther King Jr., who was one of the main leaders of that movement, that he was a good guy, right? He did amazing things. Is that agreed upon? Yes. I think so, right? Okay. Here's the thing, though. In the 1950s and 60s, when Martin Luther King was alive, he was not revered. He was despised. Like, if you look back historically at that time and place, in the 1950s and 60s, Martin Luther King Jr. was seen as a terrorist. J. Edgar Hoover, who was running the FBI at that time, he saw Martin Luther King Jr. as one of the greatest threats to democracy living inside of the United States. He tapped his phones and had people surveil him, where he found out that Martin Luther King Jr. was having extramarital affairs. And what he ended up doing was he penned a letter that he sent to, and this wasn't J. Edgar, he had one of his agents do it. Well, look at this. Sent it to Martin Luther King Jr., where it states that basically they have all of this information and they're going to blackmail him with it, and they're going to basically send this out and that you should end your own life. This is from FBI agent William Sullivan, who wrote it. Your honorary degrees, your Nobel Prize, what a grim farce, and other awards will not save you. King, I repeat, you are done. There is only one thing left for you to do. You know what it is. You have just 34 days. And they did. The FBI released this information to the press. It didn't end up doing anything, but they did release it. And the intention was commit suicide because there's no way out of this. The point of me sharing this with you is to say the king was not beloved, not just in the South, but in the North also. You may remember, King came here and he marched in Chicago. And the people here threw bricks at him while he was here, literally tried to kill him, leading him to say this: I have never seen, even in Mississippi and Alabama, mobs as hateful as I have seen here in Chicago. That's pretty tough to hear. Would you agree? Now, some of you were alive when that was going on. Some of you were even in this church while that was happening. And I ask you a question. Did this church go down there to the marches en masse to be right next to him? No. There were people in this church who absolutely did that, but not the whole church. The truth is, none of the churches around here did that. And that's because the white community as a whole, they saw him as somebody who was dangerous at that time. You ever read A Letter from a Birmingham Jail by Martin Luther King Jr.? There's this interesting line he has in there. I'm going to read it to you. First, I must confess that over the last few years, I've been gravely disappointed with the white moderate. I've almost reached the regrettable conclusion that the Negro's great stumbling block in the stride towards freedom is not the white citizen's counselor or the Ku Klux Klanner, but the white moderate who is more devoted to order than to justice, who constantly says, I agree with you in the goal you seek, but I can't agree with you in your methods of direct action, who paternalistically feels he can set the timetable for another man's freedom. And just in case you're wondering, he's talking about us. He's speaking about us. Now, I say all this to say that King was not beloved by white people. He was seen as a threat, a huge threat. Do you know what his approval rating was when he was assassinated nationally? 25%. That's how many people thought well of him when he was assassinated, 25%. Now, looking back today, you would think everybody in the United States thought he was the greatest thing since sliced bread, right? That's how people think of him now. But at the time, he was branded a communist. And you need to know, let's get this out on the table. Martin Luther King Jr., he was no fan of capitalism, and he preached against it rather often. But by branding him a communist, and if you remember in the 1950s and 60s, communism was seen as one of the greatest existential threats to democracy in the world. By doing that, the goal was to discredit him. That was why they did it. Now, I find that to be very interesting, because in the new incarnation of the civil rights movement, which is found in the Black Lives Matter movement, the exact same tag has been placed on them, that they are communists. And I've heard many, many white people say, you know, if Martin Luther King Jr. was alive today, he would never be associated with Black Lives Matter. He'd be ashamed of them. Really? I mean, I'm looking back on this and I'm thinking to myself, I think he would say, sounds pretty familiar, you know, because that's exactly what he experienced. The same thing happened. Now, I know what some of you are thinking. You're thinking, I've seen the tapes of some of the leaders and they say that they're trained Marxists. I've seen those tapes too. And I'm not trying to sit there and say that Black Lives Matter is perfect. I'm not trying to say that they haven't made mistakes. But do you really think that all those people in there, that they're all communists and Marxists? I mean, I'm just posing the question because it seems very interesting to me, right? That in the 1950s and 60s, they branded that whole movement as communists. And the same thing happens today with the new incarnation. Have you ever seen that movie, Groundhog Day, with Bill Murray? You ever seen that movie? All right, in that movie, what happens? He gets up and he's living the same day over and over again. Well, that's what this feels like to me. It's the same thing. Groundhog Day, we're waking up, it's the exact same thing. 1960s, the whole thing is communist, we're trying to discredit it. And then it happens again today, the whole thing's trying to be discredited. And this brings me to my come to Jesus moment for today. I think one of the reasons why we're struggling as a church, one of the reasons why we're dying, is because we have lost our moral legitimacy. We have this long history where our churches have contributed to racism in this country, and we don't want to take responsibility for that. We are like Pontius Pilate. What does Pontius Pilate do? He signs Jesus' death warrant, but then he says, I wash my hands of this man's death. It doesn't work that way. You can't sign a person's death warrant and then say, I don't have anything to do with it. You're still responsible. And so for us, right, a lot of this, all this stuff that I'm talking about, it came before you, right? Like a lot of this history is long before us. You didn't cause it, but what we do have to do is we have to stand up and we have to say, okay, this is part of our tradition, this is part of our history, and we're going to go in a different direction than the people who came before us. And to put this in perspective for you, I want you to think about, last week I talked about why are people in the 20s and 30s not coming to church in the way that they used to. And what you have to realize is that for many of these younger people in their 20s and 30s, they grew up very differently than many of you. They didn't grow up in a predominantly white community like what you're used to, right? Most of you in here, the way you grew up, the vast majority of you, I know that you didn't grow up where it was common to have interracial relationships. I'm not talking about like romantic relationships, I'm just talking about having friends. I know that was common. And I'm not saying it was your fault. I'm just saying that's just the way it was, right? Now, for many young people today, they grow up and that is their entire world is interracial relationships. When I was growing up, I can tell you most of my friends were not white. And today, when I see my friends coming out and saying, I care about Black Lives Matter because I care about civil rights, I come back and I say, I'm 100% behind you, man. I'm right there with you. I'm 100% behind you to let you know that you deserve the same civil rights as every other person in this country. So when people ask and say, where are all the young people? Why aren't they coming to the church? What you have to realize is that this place, which is predominantly white, that's actually uncomfortable for them. They're not used to being in all white spaces anymore. I can't tell you the number of conversations over the last 9 years that I've had with young people in their 20s and 30s who've come in to me and they say, you know, I really like what you guys are doing here, but honestly, it feels like I'm stepping back into the 1960s. They literally have said that to me. Because they're saying it feels segregated, which is what Martin Luther King Jr. said, right? What was one of his famous quotes? Was the most segregated hour in America is 11 o'clock on Sunday morning. Why is that? Because we all go to our separate churches. We all go our separate ways, right? So looking at this, I think we have to ask the question. Do we care about this issue? Does this issue matter to us as a church? Are we going to do more than just pay lip service to it? Because here's the thing. I think whether or not we realize it, those young people, when they come in here, what they're feeling, whether they can articulate it or not, is that our church is contributing to the problem of racism rather than solving it. And so we have to be part of the solution rather than part of the problem. Would you at least agree with that? You may not agree with what I'm saying, but would you at least agree we need to be part of the solution rather than part of the problem? Yes? Okay. So the question is, how are we going to do that? How do we make that happen? And that's a challenging question to answer, right? Because it's one thing, if I went around here, every single person in here would say, yeah, of course I believe in racial equality, Alex. I would assume everybody in here would say that. Doing something about it, though, much, much harder, right? So this is where I come back to what I said early on. What do we do? This is why we brought in Susan Burton. Susan Burton's organization works with women who have been released, right? They've come out of incarceration. The vast majority of these women who they work with are black and brown, because those are the people who tend to get caught up in our criminal justice system. If we work with them, we're at least doing a little bit of our part. We're not going to solve this whole problem on our own, but we can do a little bit to make a contribution to try to make it right. And why do we do this? Why does it matter? It matters because Jesus teaches us that this is important. Why does Jesus go into the temple? Why does he go into the temple and overturn the tables of the money changers and the sellers of the sacrifices? Why does he do that? He does it because Rome has infiltrated into their religion. Every priest had to be loyal to Rome. And then the soldiers are around, and the soldiers, they can hurt you, they can commit violence on you, they can arrest you for no reason. They're being discriminated against, and he was tired of it. He was standing up for his people. He was going in there and he's saying, no more of this. He was telling his disciples, he was showing them, you cannot wait for justice to come. You have to be the change you want to see in the world. And so the question we have to answer is, are we going to take that teaching seriously? Or are we going to set it aside and say, not for us? And I get it, guys. Like, I get how saying something like this is hard. Because when you stand for something, what ends up happening? If you're going to put your foot down and say, we stand for something, that's going to make other people uncomfortable, and it's going to cause them to walk away. But when you stand for nothing, you very quickly become nothing, and you lose your legitimacy. Jesus fought for his people, and it cost him his life. And he asked the same of us. What does it say in Mark 8? Those of you who wish to become my disciple, take up your cross and follow me. For those who want to save their life will lose it. That's the one where you sit there and say, not for me. I'm going to step back. I'd rather, you know, it's hard. I don't know if I want to do that. And those who lose their life for my sake and for the sake of the gospel will save it. Are you willing to go in? Are you willing to take the hard path? Make those hard decisions. I can't tell you how many people I've heard who said to me, you know, if I was alive in the 1950s and 60s, oh man, I would have been at the marches, I would have been at the sit-ins, I would have been right there. Well, guess what? Racism is still alive and well today. And we have an opportunity to make a difference. So the question is, are you going to take the mantle of racial justice upon you, or are you going to set it aside? And I want to tell you right now, right? It's your choice, not mine. This is not up to me. This is up to you. I'm the pastor who points the way, you make the decision. But I will tell you, if you choose to set it aside, what I think is going to happen is, when this place goes away, that history, that legacy of racism, will be written upon our tombstone. And I'm not here to try to make, like, again, this is not about guilt. If you're feeling guilty, that's not what I want. What I want is for you to say, I acknowledge the history of racism that brought us here. I'm one of the most guilty. I have a slave owner in my family. Okay? Most of you can't say that. I'm up here talking from experience. We have this whole legacy of racism behind us. You didn't cause that. I didn't cause that. But we acknowledge it. We say it's there. And we're going to do something different going forward. We're going to make a different choice than the people who came before us. That's what we're trying to do. And so the question is, are you going to do that? Are you going to stand up? Are you going to speak out? Are you going to make a difference, even though it's hard? And if you do, I promise you, I'll be walking right next to you all the way. Amen.
Thanks for listening. And if you want to learn more about First Presbyterian Church of Arlington Heights, please visit www.firstpresah.org for more information on service times, directions, and to learn more about the First Pres family of faith.